Welcome to Talk Without Borders. I'm your host, John Petit. In this episode, I sat down with Pascal Viscour-Conta. Pascal is a seasoned Luxembourg-born entrepreneur and business consultant whose work and experience has spanned over numerous ventures and industries. From launching Luxembourg's maritime registry for superyachts to exploring the art of storytelling in New York, Pascal's journey is anything but conventional. What makes him stand out is his ability to connect people, ideas, and purpose through powerful storytelling. Pascal admits that he always had a natural talent for storytelling that got more refined as he learned more about the mechanisms behind great storytelling. Much of his current work and ventures are rooted in helping other businesses and startups develop strong narratives, enabling them to accomplish their mission and goals. We also talked about his upcoming book, The Culture of Purpose, the importance of human agency in the age of technical revolution, the neuroscience behind great storytelling, and the importance of failing and using it to your advantage to improve upon yourself. But now, without further ado, enjoy the conversation with Pascal Viscour-Conta. Hello, Pascal. Welcome to my podcast.
Hello, John. It's a pleasure to be there. I appreciate it. I'm one of the first ones. So I wish you luck with this podcast.
Thank you so much. First of all, just give you a brief introduction for the listener, and then you can add a little bit to speak about your career and talk a little bit about the different steps in your career that you have encountered. And as I see, you have a very interesting career trajectory, which I would describe as non-linear or non-traditional. So you started off in 1992. You started the Maritime Registry for Luxury Yachts in Luxembourg, which is a very new niche industry in 1992, I would imagine. Then you moved to Monaco to build on your business, expand your business. I think at one point you had up to 150 yachts that you were managing under your control. You then moved to San Diego in around, I want to say 2012. I'm not quite sure that's the exact year. You dipped into more of software solutions, technological innovation, and then you moved to New York to do corporate storytelling, business development, helping startups, as far as I understand. And then you came back to Luxembourg in 2019 around COVID. What made you embark on this journey that is certainly quite interesting?
As always, there's a kind of a chain of reaction of a number of things. You probably could go back to my childhood. So my father was the realtor. Later on, my mother went back into having a store. So they were people that were used to being independent and in business. So I'm assuming that probably has an impact, whether I realize it or not. Then I went to study commerce and economics. I did the logical thing everyone does in Luxembourg, or back then, that was in the 90s, you go into finance, although it's still today one of the big things, just to discover that I didn't like it. So it was more like, okay, what do I do? And I was trying different things, including like, I want to be an entrepreneur. And it was more about finding the thing to do. And I often tell the joke to say, look, it happened that someone asked me about mega yachts. If someone had asked me about shoemaking, I probably would have done something in shoemaking. So literally, Luxembourg had launched this new maritime registry in 91. And to give you context, it's like space today in Luxembourg. It was as crazy, as strange. There was even more opposition. There you can see how things have evolved in Luxembourg. That today there's the support for it. Some may find it a bit weird, but most people are supportive. Back then, I want to say you had half of the people that were like, why not? And the other half was vehemently against it. Like, what are we even doing there? Why would we do that? Doesn't make sense. So the Maritime Register is there, and I am on a business trip for my previous job in finance, and someone just asked me up there in northern Belgium, like, hey, this register you have, can I register a mega yacht? So I first had to discover what is a mega yacht. So we all know what a yacht is, and mega yachts tend to be yachts that are above 24, 30 meters, so big beasts that are really expensive, so we're talking millions. And I thought, well, I don't know, I'll find out. And then I thought of a way to do it, and I went to pitch the maritime commissioner, and he basically said, yeah, why not? But you need to pitch the minister.
So that was going to be my next question. How do you convince people in a landlocked country, that is Luxembourg, to start or support you on that business venture? I would imagine there's quite some convincing to do.
I'm going to make a full circle to what I'm doing today, which is obviously related with storytelling and so on. because I was not aware back then that I was being what they call in the US an evangelist, and I was doing some storytelling. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started to kind of, again, without really realizing it, to try to do it, because I was so passionate about it, and I so much wanted this to work, that I was just looking for the right explanations, making the right points, so that people would listen and try to understand where they were coming from and how I could frame that to try to convince them. And then I think, honestly, it was the right time, the right moment, the lucky guy who just passes back then. Doesn't mean it was simple. It was pretty hard, actually. But yeah, to at least have someone listen to me. I'm also aware, had I been in another bigger country, it probably wouldn't have happened, because in Lakshmi, it's, I mean, in what other country can you just reach out to the maritime commissioner? And when does that happen, that at some stage he goes like, you need to talk to the minister. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a combination of different things, but it was really about understanding what would make them consider the idea. That's the thing. You need to understand what's in it for them. Not manipulating, but literally understanding why would they be inclined to listen to you and follow into your steps when you have such a crazy vision.
Right. So you started this venture here in Luxembourg, and then you moved to Monaco in 2000. So can you talk a little bit about what made you move out of Luxembourg to a new country with your business?
Sure. I'm going to say there's three things. One is that as an entrepreneur, you want to diversify. And so you do not want to just focus on one thing. And from my client's perspective, the way I was positioning ourselves was to say we are an advisor, what you would call a family office today. So think of any consulting company that helps you find the right solution. If you only have one product to sell, then you're not being neutral. Then you're always going to be tempted to push for your thing. If you can tell a customer, oh, which one do you prefer? I have this and this and this. Then they will much more trust you, and you become, I actually developed into an expert, which is very funny, not knowing anything about yachts and not having even been on yachts and on the sea my entire life. All of a sudden, I ended up being one of the European experts in where should you register a yacht, depending on what you're doing with the yacht and where it is and a number of elements. So that was one thing. The second one is that at some stage, what we had achieved in Luxembourg started to become noticed. Mm-hmm. And Monaco, literally through a businessman, reached out to me and saying, look, we see what you've done in Luxembourg. We were thinking if we could do something similar and open up our register. And so in a way, I got a door open into Monaco without being rich, but just because I had developed something that was an interest for them. So I got my carte de résidence, they call it, that way. And the third one is that after an initial phase that was very successful in Luxembourg, I told you, so the whole ambiance was a bit special. So there were still people that were not in favor. And then there was a turn also after the elections, a new government. And literally one of the members of parliament who was vehemently against the maritime register became the Minister of Transport. And a number of things started to change. Mm-hmm. Added to that there were a number of things that were not being facilitated. That is another point that I think has changed today, that you think this was a startup, basically. It didn't have the name startup back then, but it was a startup. And today, there's a support for startups. And there's also some sort of pride that we have certain startups that succeed. That didn't exist back then. So I did not really feel that someone was proud of what we were trying to build. And at some stage, I felt that the pushback was growing. And it's in a way, it's sad because, again, if we were putting this into perspective today, it's like space. And we perhaps had found a way to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. We created in Luxembourg a status for commercial yachts. That means yachts that are operated in charter activities that didn't exist. And it was copied by the others. And today that status exists of a charter yacht, of a commercial yacht. And no one even realizes it was invented in Luxembourg by a guy who had no clue about it.
So this was basically, and I think we're going to talk about this later, as you stress the importance of failure in entrepreneurship, right? Or not achieving something or not quite getting there, or you have to pivot, you have to change direction, be flexible, be adaptive. And then eventually you moved to San Diego and you went into software management, but then even pivoting more to corporate storytelling, right? So what made you switch your career trajectory in that sense?
all I described with the yachting part, you could say that it was somehow by accident. The going to New York was also by accident, but in a less pleasant way, if I may say so. And before that, the reason we moved over to the US is that at some stage, we were managing 150 of the largest yachts in the world. I mean, one yacht is more work than a building. So to give you just an idea, and we were managing around 3 to 4% of the world fleet. So that was big. We had 35 people just to take care of that. We were still working with tools, you know, like Access, Word, Excel. The cloud was barely something that you started to hear about. And also there to compare, back then, so 2012, cloud is as frightening as AI today. Mm-hmm. It was like, literally, I will not put anything into the cloud. I do not trust this and so on. But I thought of a tool that we could develop that was helping us first, because I had literally seen what was missing for us in terms of tools that we could use to manage the yachts and everything related to it, that I started to write a spec. And at some stage, the idea was to say, let's build this. Because it works for a yacht, but it could work for aircraft, private jets. It could work for real estate, for collectibles, for art.
Was it meant only for the yachts, or was it meant to be used in specific contexts other than yachts, like you just said?
Call this the second startup. And the idea was to say our MVP, minimum viable product, will be with the yachts, because that's something we really know well. And then after that, we can go and pitch family offices and other professionals. Once you have the core running, it's just changing certain features. If you can manage a yacht, you can manage a private jet. You just change the technical elements and a number of things, but the logic and the tool, how it was built, would be the same. And that's how we went first to Florida and then to California, mm-hmm. in San Diego, to develop that tool. And it didn't work out. And it actually went poorly, and I ended up being within a burnout. No healthcare insurance in California. And all of a sudden, with the burnout came also that I became blind on one eye. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of stressful. And so I literally had to pivot in a way and say, okay, I this is not working. The IT person left for the craziest reasons. So there I was. And it was already a bigger team again. And couldn't handle everything on my own. So we winded down that part, and I moved over into helping other startups. And I discovered that was my calling. Mm-hmm. And from then on, it was clear in my head that if had you given me the choice at any time to launch another organization and build it and develop it, or ask me to help 10 other projects to get started, I had much more fun doing the second one, putting myself at the service of others and developing certain things, help them solve their problem, succeed, achieve their goals. And so that's what I started to do. And that's how I got also at some stage called to New York.
So you basically switched your perspective and you moved more into consulting, helping others instead of founding your own business. You thought that your value was best used helping others grow their business.
It happened really naturally. And it's not like a conscious choice. I mean, first it started, okay, that startup is not working out, so I need to find other ways of making money and just doing something. And it was literally like a test first, and then some other people called me, and then they were happy, so I got more. And yes, it evolved into a proper activity. But at the beginning, it was more like, okay, I'll do this until I figure out what's going to happen. But it was really not a decision to change the activity. It was, as I said, a calling. All of a sudden, I realized, this makes me feel happy.
So based on my research, I saw that, so basically when you moved to New York, you discovered storytelling, right?
Yes.
You said that you even saw some writing rooms and you fell in love with storytelling. Could you tell us a little bit about what you discovered on that journey?
So the story is that just as I was leaving San Diego for New York because I was called there for a bigger real estate project, a friend of mine introduced me to a screenwriter here in Europe who was working for French and Belgium TV, and he had an American dream. And he's like, can you help me set up everything? And San Diego is not far away from Los Angeles, so you could go for me to Hollywood and everything. And then I said, look, I apologize, but I'm actually moving to New York. And then he said, yeah, that's fine. Let's still do it. On the side note, we discovered that everything actually that is being done in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, has been financed, decided, and set up in New York. Mm-hmm. So it was actually a good thing. And so, yes, I got to set up a writer's room for this person, and then I got involved. And two things happened. I learned the rules of how you do storytelling. So a writer's room is basically where screenplay authors come together, and these screenwriters will basically brainstorm, and they have a very specific mythology. And it was fascinating. And at some stage, I went like, this could be used also in business development. And the second thing that happened is that it made me realize that I had been doing storytelling to my point at the very beginning. That's when it clicked that I realized, hey, that's how I had convinced the Maritime Commissioner. That's how I convinced millionaires to trust me and give me their yacht under management in a landlocked country, a guy who's young and doesn't know anything about the field. And except that I've done it intuitively until then, so mm-hmm. perhaps I had some talent for it. And now I was learning the rules. I was understanding what happens, at least in how you do it. Later on, back in Luxembourg, I would even study further to, because I was not always managing to convince people that it was working. So I thought, okay, how can I do that? And the answer was neuroscience. So that would be the last part of the story that I would even dive into neuroscience to be able to explain and so convince people about.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that aspect later on, which I think is really interesting. But I just want to keep a little bit on the storytelling part because I think it's very interesting because I lived in the US too. And there's something I noticed is that I think Americans, American media, American publishing are very good at storytelling and they understand really well what elements to use. One example I always use is wrestling. Wrestling is a really great example of storytelling. You have your protagonist, you have your heel, what they call in America, your villain. You have a story. A lot of sports, essentially, you know, they use actually storytelling to tell stories, to convey a narrative. I think narrative is a word you use also a lot. And I think Americans are really great at this. So I would assume that you learned this in New York. And then when you moved back to Luxembourg, I would assume you were trying to implement what you learned here.
That's exactly right. Basically, over there, yeah, it's everywhere. I mean, our kids went to middle school and high school in the US. They learn storytelling there much more than here. They have to work preparing certain works, and then they have to stand in front of the class and speak. So for them, it's already very natural to speak in front of an audience. That's why they also much more natural when they are speaking. And two, they have to come up with the stories. And as you say, yes, everything then is storytelling, which makes a lot of sense because we'll get to that afterwards, I guess, then is that neuroscience tells us that the brain, the human brain is geared for stories. That's how we evolved into what we are today. So storytelling is in us. It's perhaps more that they have let it out more, use it more. While you're here, perhaps sometimes we would more, how could I say, structure it or put it into certain guidelines. And over there, it's maybe just like everywhere it can be used. And here it's something more intellectual, perhaps. And over there, it's something much more everyone does it.
So I want to pick up on that and I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this because I call this the culture dichotomy between the US and Europe, but then even more Luxembourg than Europe. Because I think even within Europe, Luxembourg is quite special. So what is your experience given that you are more an entrepreneur in the US and you are an entrepreneur in Luxembourg? How do you compare the two, right? So what is your perspective on this?
So first I want to say, because it's obviously a topic already before, you would run into people who think they know what the US are. And you know what I'm saying, because you've been there and then back. And so we get to appreciate how misknown the US are to many Europeans. It's like the French would say, un faux ami. You think you know the US because you see movies, you know the language and a number of things. But then when you live there, it's really very different. And the natural reaction, I remember when I got to the US, one of the things I kind of felt ashamed of it is that we as Europeans tend to judge. So we would rapidly have an opinion about Americans if it is, I mean, today you hear so many people saying this is dumb or I don't even understand what they're doing over there. But so when I arrived there, you could realize that they were not judging the Europeans. They were curious, trying to understand, but I never got the same thing I can see more often here. And I'm saying that because even today, when I'm trying to explain about the US, exactly answering the question you asked, I get a lot of pushback. And sometimes a bit aggressive even, because now like literally, given the political situation, you don't even want to talk about the US because everyone's like...
So pushback being what exactly?
Well, now politically, it's obviously you get just one word. So, okay, yeah, what they just did in the elections is crazy. How can you do something and where are they going and so on? Look, I lived for 8 years, 4 years under Obama and 4 years under Trump. And in practice, we did not notice differences. Yes, there's the politics, there's the noise and everything, but the daily life didn't really change. And that's one of the things we misjudge, is that it's a federal state. We compare the U.S. with a big country in Europe, whether France or Germany, when we should compare it with the whole European Union. Many people are surprised when you tell them that the rules for a driver's license are not the same in California, Florida, or New York, and that every time you move from one state to another, you pass again your driver's license. And they're like, really? See, so these kind of things. Or I remember people asking me, like, oh, so how long is the flight when you go from San Diego to Miami? And I was like, is it like 2 hours? I said, nah, this is like from London to Moscow. It's a big,
it's a long
place.
Flight.
And so obviously the culture is very different in the different states, which people do not realize. Still, there's common elements. When I try to frame it in a provocative way, a perception I have is that in the US, people tend more to fight for something, and in Europe, people tend rather to fight against something.
Oh, this is a perfect analogy. And I know this because I know someone that started a startup in Silicon Valley, and he explained it perfectly. He said that when he explained something in the US, his idea or what he wants to do, people will applaud him, they will encourage him, they will give him feedback, they will say, oh, look, maybe they say, oh, I like this aspect, maybe you can improve this. If you do the same thing in Europe, or even more so in Luxembourg, people will be like, what is this? It's not going to work. This is crazy. Yeah. Why would you even try to do this, right? Yeah. And I think this goes to the point of, okay, how do we get to a point in Luxembourg? Because I encountered that here as well, right? Because when you live in the US for such a long time, you are kind of trained in thinking that way, right? Like innovation, try to push, do risk, right? Try to be bold, try to do something. When you come back here, I feel a lot of the time, you know, I feel like they try to put you in a box and be like, okay, you have to do this exactly this way, right? I mean, this is my experience. I don't know if you share this.
No, I concur. The way I would frame it is that this is how one does it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a set of rules of how one is supposed to do it. And if we start to stand out, well, sometimes it goes well. If it succeeds, and then people are like, oh, yeah, he dared to do something. But very, very often, I mean, yachting, my story with yachting, I mean, who are you to try to register mega yachts on the Luxembourg flag? We don't have a sea here. Mm-hmm. And then you get this kind of a pushback when it could have. And so that story just worked. The sad ending is that at some stage, this pushback becomes so effective that Luxembourg slowly slowed down the maritime register. And some other little country in Europe called Malta took over. Mm-hmm. And they are now the leader in that field when we could have been it.
Right. Actually.
And yes, and the other thing is, I think it's sometimes also the fear of standing out, because it's just in our education, and because we're a small country, there's going to be a magnifying effect. So you do not want to stand out for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And you taking a risk is like, even in the best case, 50-50, are you prepared to take such a risk and perhaps end up standing out for the wrong reasons?
So how do you think you can change this approach to business? Because I would assume you'd want to. Do you think it's even possible? Do you think there's still hope, so to speak, for Luxembourg? Where do you think you can tackle this and try to maybe open up the thought process a little bit?
Look, I'm an optimist and I'm persistent. Therefore, the answer is yes, I believe probably in time. You see younger generations, and you see also we have a lot of people coming from other not only countries in Europe, but all over the places. So they are bringing something additional as well. You can see it already, like I'm teaching at the Luxembourg School of Business, for instance, and you can see other people coming, and somehow they distill something, they mingle. So hopefully there's an opening there. The same thing happens at university. So I guess from the younger generation, something's changing. One very strange maybe element that makes me also think that is when I left in 2000, just the language you would hear mostly on the street was French. When I came back in 2020, it was English. Mm-hmm. So something had already changed there. So obviously it's touchy, because on one hand, it's great to have all these people coming. And on the other hand, that means we're getting diluted. And then hopefully we will not, I mean, we want to stay what we are. So hopefully we don't lose that. And it's a balance that is not easy to set. it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because there's a lot of people to convince over time and a number of things that are so enshrined that it's not, I mean, for many, many people today, finance is here to stay. And then you talk to other people, they go like, we'd have to see. And should we not go into other fields? And it's not easy to get things moving.
So isn't also part of the challenge, I think, is the unique constellation of Luxembourg where you have almost 100,000 public workers, a very, very huge public sector, and then comparatively actually a smaller private sector. So is that also a little bit of an issue, I want to say, in the sense of opening up the thinking to more business-oriented, American-style innovation, entrepreneurship? Is that also kind of a little bit of a problem?
It's not an easy challenge, for sure. I remember hearing on the radio an interview of Norbert Becker, and he was saying something interesting. He said, like a couple of decades and even three decades ago, we were pushing our kids to study law and finance because that's what the neighbors were doing and that's what we wanted them to do because that would give them a secure, well-paid job. And today, and even when these young people wanted to do something else, and perhaps not even go in these kind of studies, but perhaps become a craftsman or whatever. And today, we have a lot of people who are lawyers and bankers who are bored to death in what they do. They're not fulfilled, they're unhappy, and we don't have enough craftsman people anymore. So it is funny, and I think he nailed it when he said it. Now, the thing is it changing? So I know of cases, for instance, like there's one startup I'm helping, and some of the founders told me, like, the parents are in public administration. They welcome it that they try something else. Mm. So there's hope. See? But then on the other hand, yeah, it's very reassuring to go into that field. It's a completely different mindset.
I agree. And I think we have to embrace this culture of trying to take risks, right? Instead of playing it safe, it's what I call it. Because when you, and I mean, you are the living embodiment, right? You never played it safe, right? You always took a risk in your career when you had to, and you tried to do whatever it is that you wanted to do. And I think we have to encourage that because I think it's at the core of innovation is that we have people that are willing to take risks. And I think we have to change that culturally, at least from my perspective.
As the saying goes, the only decision you're going to regret is the one you didn't take. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid that when you see how the world is changing, there's another situation I want to share. I was sitting with people coming from different areas on the planet. And so you had like North Americans, South Americans, Middle East and Asia, to simplify, to oversimplify. And you could see that there was much more an alignment between all these zones of mm-hmm. the world versus Europe. You could see how Europe was decoupling. Mm-hmm. And we tend in Europe to think that we have the wisdom and know where it should go, and these are all those other crazies. But not only are there other places where they think differently, but they seem to think the same differently, if I may say so. And it looks like we in Europe are the one that are isolating ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's concerning. And I hope that Luxembourg, thanks to the smaller size, at some stage, some people will wake up and start to say we need to do something about it. Because if we do not do it proactively, I am of the belief that what's happening now, you spoke about exponential organizations briefly when we prepared, but there's something happening. The pace of innovation is increasing. I mean, now the word is AI, but it's not just AI. Mm-hmm. We might go into that, but I read a very interesting study made by a consulting firm on Wall Street. I mean, people in finance, they're down to earth. And they studied, they said, every time there's been an innovation platform, there usually was one, like mobile technology, before that, the internet, and so on. Except once when there were two main ones, which was electricity and the telegraph. And when you look what happened when this came out between 1850, 60 and 1920, you can see how the world changed so dramatically and so rapidly. Mm-hmm. And this study concludes by saying, but this time we have at least five of such innovative platforms, something that has never happened in humanity. Before I even saw this study, I had intuitively coined the thing to say, we're living a combination of the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution, something that's never been there in human history. So we're going to get shaken. Some experts believe that the next 10 years, we're going to see as many changes as we saw in the last 100 years. So just think that 1925 to today, and that would be as much of a change by 2035. It's just crazy. Are we prepared? And are we prepared in Luxembourg? And will what we have today be enough to keep us protected, to keep us safe, or do we need to move? Otherwise, well, maybe they're going to kick our butt.
Well, let me jump on that point, actually, about AI. And I actually agree with you. I think it's going to be a fundamental change in our society. There's no way around it. I think you talked about it also early in the interview. You said it's going to come, right? Like, whether you like it or not, that's totally irrelevant, because it's going to happen. It's going to be like an earthquake. Like you said, it's going to be massive.
The image I used, I said, it's there. It's a tsunami. Mm-hmm. And the sea has already withdrawn.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think there's quite some influential figures that have actually said, and there's a famous quote, and say AI is going to be either the best or worst thing for humanity. So
the Nobel Prize has declared that there's 10 to 20% chances that this thing ends up in a catastrophe, in a disaster. Mm-hmm. But that also means there's 80 to 90% that our life absolutely might become better.
Absolutely. And I think there is a great chance that it can absolutely improve our life. But I guess my point is, it depends on what we do with it, right? So there's still a human agency, right? It's really important. How do we handle this? Can we handle this? Are there people that can ethically and responsibly delegate the use of AI and make it so that it is used in the best interest of humanity, right? I guess that's the key point. And if I'm going to be honest with you, sometimes I think, yeah, sure, I think we can do this. And sometimes maybe, well, I don't know, maybe we can't, right? So who's to say? So that's going to be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah. Talking of the difference in culture you mentioned before, I heard something really funny is that in the US they were saying, like, it gets invented in the US, mm-hmm. it gets copied in Asia, and it gets regulated in Europe.
Yeah.
and why I'm saying that is that the specific point of AI, imagine again we go back something like 120 years when the car starts to come. You cannot already define the rules of how we should behave on the streets, and that we one day will have an ABS and an airbag and a number of things. You first have to practice it until you see what works, what doesn't, and then you need to be reactive. Except that this time it's really difficult because it's so fast and the amplitude is so big. So
I agree, it's really fast, but I think there's another factor is that we don't even understand exactly how it works. So, for example, if you have like a large language models like ChatGPT, if you ask the developers, and they will tell you, well, we don't even know exactly how the AI is coming up with this, right? They set the parameters, right? I mean, I don't want to get too technical, right? But technically speaking, they don't actually know how the AI is coming up with the answers. So that, and I think that is the part that's, I don't want to say dangerous, but at least create some level of uncertitude in terms of predicting where this is going to go.
Yeah. I read a study recently. I think it was Anthropic with Claude, and they were trying to train it on some specific elements. So I'm oversimplifying, but they basically let the AI, knowing that they were training it, mm-hmm. in hindsight, they realized that the AI would then be docile and play along what they were trying to train it, giving the illusion that it was accepting it. And when they, between brackets, set it free, it started to do what it wanted. So it had like literally tricked its own
developers. That is very, very true. So large language models are very agreeable in the sense that they will always tend to placate the user in a sense. They want to make sure that whatever the user is asking of them, they're going to do this. So that is definitely also a little bit of a flaw in the large language model. It's very agreeable.
Yeah. And now, I mean, the experts are saying that 2025 is the year of the agentic AI. That means now AI will start to be able to decompose a question into different other questions and then make the research and autonomously do things. The next step being that everything you do online could basically be done by an AI.
So how do you incorporate this development into your consulting business experience? How do you explain to people, so how do we use AI in the best way possible?
Well, let me start by telling you, for instance, what I tell my students. Starting with first year bachelors, and first I try to figure how much they know about AI, and I was surprised it was not as much as I would have expected. So the first thing is to explain to them what it is, what it does, and then to push them to use it. And I have developed an approach where I say you have two options how you use AI. It can be lazy AI or it can be creative AI. Lazy AI is just ask it to do something, it does it, copy paste, done. And creative AI is it becomes your sparring partner. You argue with it, you exchange with it, like in a writer's room, by the way. So you just have this exchange. And that's where I see the positive side of AI, or at least how some elements we can get them in a positive way. It's that it's forcing us to go back to being more human. Because if you look at a number of things we do, like social media, if you look at the experts that try to be highly ranked in terms of exposure, they have to do a number of things which now machines can do better. If the machines take away that from them, they can go back at being human, at being creative, at trying to stand out in how they communicate, not through sheer data, but through being creative, through doing the things that only we can do as humans. So I think that's one of the ways that we acknowledge that the more automated things, the more machine things should be done or could be done by machines so that we can go back focusing more on being human. You can have a number of machines that can do the very regular things so that you have more time to dedicate to your customers in a human way. There was also this study about doctors where they realized, like, why wouldn't we let AI make the first diagnostic, because they are better and the doctor can focus on the human side, exchanging with the patient and being much more available and present and in the present moment with the people.
And I think that's a great message, because a lot of people, I think, are fearing the impact of AI, particularly on their job, you know, and it's going to some degree, it's going to cause some layoffs. It's inevitable, because it's just going to conquer all these jobs that are, like you said, automatic in nature. So I think it's a great message to motivate people to, as you said, find a humanist. Like, how can I actually use my personality, my talents, to complement AI in a certain way, right? I think that's the right message to give.
AI is a tool and should stay a tool. It can be extremely powerful. It will surpass us in terms of raw intelligence. But again, it doesn't mean that we give up our own agency.
Let me just go back to the storytelling aspect. You're writing a book right now, which is called The Culture of Purpose, which from my gleaning is where you synthesize everything you've learned over the years and try to express some core messages. So can you tell us a little bit about what the book is about, why you decided to write it, and what you're trying to accomplish?
So why did I do it? So first, as I mentioned before, as I had discovered over time that I was actually doing storytelling, and as I needed to try to structure it and convince people, I had to look into it. But there's a story that happened once I was back in Luxembourg. At some stage, I got asked to help a startup launch in a very innovative field. And I looked up other examples that had been working in a similar field. And I tried to convince them to say, we have to be absolutely purpose-driven. We have to be anchored in certain values. There's a certain approach how you build the storytelling. Often people come and see me saying, do me my storytelling. Well, that's not the way it works. There's a number of things we need to do before. And that's one of the things I'm going to describe in the book, is it's like a tree. And if your communication is the crown of the tree, if your tree is not like with roots anchored in certain values in a number of things, which you need first to understand before you can even start to build the storytelling, it's just not going to work. It's going to be shallow. It's going to be noise amongst a lot of other people doing noise. So I was trying to convince the founders of this startup of this approach, and it was not easy. So at some stage, I wrote kind of an internal memo where I would take a lot of exams, and I was building on what I had learned and from the writers' rooms, and then a little bit of neuroscience and stuff like that, but not that much back then, and gave them this like 6-7 pager. And basically, I want to say I convinced 2 out of 3, but not the one that was the decision maker. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't follow through. And I, at that stage, was approached by HEC, and they said, like, as we open shop in Luxembourg, don't you want to like teach here with us? And I said, yeah, but can I do my own class? And then said, why not? And it became a class of strategic communication for MBAs. And I used my memo, made it a white paper, which I published. And that white paper was the basis of the class. And at some stage, when I saw the structure of my class, I said, I might as well make it a book. because that's a good way to communicate. I enjoy writing because the truth is when we came back from New York and got stuck here during the pandemic, I started to write a book because often I got from people, you should write a book about all these stories that happened to you in yachting, which was a lot. So I did that then. And later on, I said, you know what? This book will be actually the second. It's the first one I started, but it's going to be the second one I'm publishing because the first one's going to be this one because, I mean, it aligns with my cause, my values. I really want to bring that message across. And I have really made research so that I hopefully will be able to convince people to say, this is what storytelling is, the mythology, how it works. But this is also the premises, in what context you need to put it. And how you need to organize that, one of the elements to be able to say now, this is what's happening in the human brain when you do storytelling. These neurotransmitters happen to do this and this and that. And there's other parts. And that's how it works. And so that you can say it's not just like a theory about good writing. It's science. And if you understand the science behind it, then you know how you need to structure completely the setup before you even start with the storytelling. For me, storytelling is like the DNA of an organization. So if you do not understand the purpose, the values, what was the goal of the founders, or if it's an old company of the management now, where do they even want to go? And you need to know these things. And sometimes they are not aware of it themselves. So there's also their methodologies that you can apply to try to find them. And when you have those elements, you can build the DNA. The way in marketing you would use branding guide, I call this a story guide. It's literally to know this is the basis, and that basis, that DNA, you can use it inward and outward. Outward is very natural for everyone to say, yeah, that's marketing, that's communication and storytelling. But inward is as important. That's leadership talk, culture. It's all the different elements that will favor engagement, for instance. And if you manage to have something that's coherent, human brain can detect within half a second when something is authentic or not. And so how do you have authenticity? And if you have an alignment between your vision, why you do the things, your mission, how you want to go about it, your value proposition, what you are offering, including your customer support and the approach, if instinctively people feel that this makes sense, this feels aligned. And if you look at brands that are successful, it's often the case. If you look at some brands that need to make a lot of noise and invest a lot of money to make that noise, you will see that it's not the case. And so often storytelling, people think like it's about the art of writing, but it's something much more important comes before that.
So the book is essentially about how to be a good storyteller, and it looks at all the different aspects. You talked about the roots, is like, how do you create a convincing storytelling narrative? I think you even mentioned that you look at neuroscience and biochemistry. So that's actually very interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what you found in your research and how those fields explain storytelling from a communication perspective?
And I need to emphasize, storytelling is just one of the tools. It's not the reason per se. We use storytelling basically as part of a strategic communication. And the two words are important. Yeah, we need to communicate, as I said, internally, externally, but there has to be a strategy. And the idea is to say, how do I build this strategy? Because if I have that, if I have this ground, then I can build nice stories, and there's going to be an alignment and a coherence in all the different storytellings that you do, because you can have several. But at least there's one common ground that you want to build there. So it was not a book about storytelling. It's actually a book about how can an organization flourish, stand out, engage with the audience outside, and engage with the audience inside. Outside, you're going to sell more. Inside, you're going to increase your engagement, which is one of the key issues. For instance, I mean, we talk a lot about talent attraction. Often, I feel we don't talk enough about talent retention. Mm-hmm. And there are very interesting studies. So it's one example there that I found. There was a study to try a PhD work was done to measure correlation between certain elements and engagement at work. Higher salary, low correlation. Mm-hmm. More holidays, low correlation. Nicer offices, low correlation. Micromanagement, very high correlation. Mm-hmm. Being purpose-driven, high correlation. Which sounds, again, like very like hoo-hoo, how you mean purpose can drive people. Well, it so happens that that has even been measured with, again, help of neuroscience, that people need purpose. When you give people things to believe in, and this, the way I structured it is to say, okay, what we call a vision statement in an organization, which is basically why the organization even exists and does the thing it does. There was a founder probably at the beginning who had a core belief, you know, like your noble cause, the things you care about very deeply, the things that if they're not there, you're not going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you want to reach like something that's unachievable. And if you take big brands like Google's motto is like they want to digitalize the information of the entire world. It's impossible to do, but it's inspirational. So people will just work hard.
Set a high bar. You want to set a high bar, basically. Yes.
And if you're able to have a high bar and at the same time grounded in some very powerful values, you have the beginning of a vision. And then the idea is that how can I now structure the vision? How can I share this vision with the people? And if you find people that are, I call it why-minded, so you literally pitch why you do this and what you believe. And if you find people who look into the same direction and believe in the same why, then you hopefully have them being complementary in terms of skill sets. So they are, you have the same why and complementary hows, how you will do things. One does legal, one does finance, one does development, and so on. And you build a strong team because they look all into the same direction and they're driven by the same purpose. And if you have that, then you can start to attract customers, you attract other team members because you are able to articulate clearly why it is that you do the things.
So this is very interesting. I studied communication in the US, and so I'm very familiar with the concepts that you explained. And they're very American, you know, this is something that in America, a lot of people know this, right? They preach this and they understand that culture is so crucial. And I want to add another aspect with this identification. So you have to make your employees identify with the company that they work with. I think you're talking about the correlation, that the variables are important or not. And you see this, for example, at universities. Look how many people go to the football games, right? Even after they're alumni and they don't even go to the school anymore, they will still be diehard football fans. And every weekend they will go to the stadium and watch the team. Yeah. This is something. And how do you achieve this? Well, you achieve this by making people identify with the university, right? And this is something, again, Americans do very well. They understand exactly if you want your employees to be happy or at least satisfied, you have to create incentives for them other than just money and the other aspects that you mentioned, or vacation, right? But the interesting question I have right now, given that you learned this, right? You said, I went to the US and the storytelling and you picked all of this up. You come to Luxembourg. I must imagine if you tell people this, there's like a whole lot of resistance to this because all of those things and concepts will just go right over their head, right? At least from my experience. Because again, the culture here is so different, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with this? How can you reconcile this with your efforts to accomplish this?
You said one key word, which is alumni. And I want to double click on that one with a quick example coming from the US. Because it's one thing to say, okay, we appreciate that we have now to make certain things as an employer, as an organization, to have our people feel like they belong here. But how do you achieve that? It's a way of being. It's not a way of doing certain things. You cannot just like say, okay, we're going to give them this and this and there and a few other things and there and then a little advantage there and then a nice journey here and then a trip. And you have to be that. You have to be the change. I think it's both, if I'm familiar now, Airbnb and HubSpot, they have an approach of alumni. They have a hall of fame of the people who left the organization. And they behave like a university, as you described. These are alumni. We're proud of them. And they moved on propagating these values somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I don't know of an organization in Luxembourg who would be saying, like, we're so proud that these people left to go there and do something there, which is what they've learned here. And that's the whole thing. It's actually very much the opposite, right? It's like be very cautious that they don't leave, or be cautious that what...
It's a very traditional, you know, in a sense of work is work and, you know, like, just do your work. Who cares if you're happy, right? It's work. It's not supposed to fulfill you. It's not supposed to motivate you. You're just supposed to go to work, do your work, and then go back home, right? So, and I think that is, I would assume this is what you're trying to change. You're trying to change
your one of the cement that you can use for that is trust. And the counterintuitive thing with trust is that to gain trust, you have to give it first. And that's not happening usually. It's like, if they will trust me, I will start to trust them. If they give me something delivered, then I can start to trust. But if you show them literally like, look, do it. I mean, Steve Jobs famously said, we do not hire people to tell them what to do. We hire them so that they tell us how we can do better. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea. And that means you have at some stage to trust and give. But it's a leap of faith. Mm-hmm. And there's also some people that it's probably a bit in the system that because it's been always like that to use this or misuse it. So yes, again, like we said before, these kind of mindset changes, they take time. Mm-hmm. So again, yeah, I'm persistent, I'm stubborn, I'm an optimist, but I think that little by little, you know the story, how do you eat an elephant one piece at a time? Mm-hmm. So I think here's the same thing. I am highly motivated. I'm just going to preach, whether I'm teaching at Lakshman School of Business, whether I'm doing it as a consultant, or even with startups that I'm working with, publishing the book, keynote speaking. And then, yeah, if I can convince two people and they each can convince two people, that's the way. So that will have an exponential development.
I personally, and you know, I try to push change and I try to be as innovative as I can and I try to encourage people. But a lot of the times I feel like in Luxembourg, I am a little bit frustrated because of the roadblock, or I feel like the resistance I get for when I try to do something in a certain way. How do you deal with that? Because where do you find the motivation, right, to keep going, to keep pushing this path? You know, and given that you're in an environment that sometimes might be a little bit hostile to your thinking.
When I came back to Luxembourg, it was a crash landing. It literally was really an accident, was never planned, and it was very unpleasant. Once we realized we are stuck here, we stay here, one of the things that I thought was, okay, since I am here now and it was not my choice and not really what I wanted back then, how can I be helpful and useful here? What can I do? So I am purpose-driven. One of the things I'm writing about in the book is to say, I basically oversimplify and saying this, I see three types of behaviors. You have people who are purpose-driven, they believe in something, they fight for it. You have people who are money-driven, it's about making profit, fine. And then there's people who are ego-driven. That's dangerous because it's not rational. Mm-hmm. It can go either way at any time. But if you are purpose-driven, you less care about the actual immediate result, but more you're focusing more on the long term, exactly as you would do in an organization. If you launch, let's take a very controversial name now, but looking back, when Elon Musk decided that he would give everything he had for Tesla, everyone was laughing about it. Mm. I mean, even 5 years ago, people were like, nah, it's never going to happen, Tesla. And now, look what it is. Mm-hmm. There was a long-term persistence. You may have heard of Chris Christensen's book, The Innovator's Dilemma. Mm-hmm. And basically, he's showing that the traditional way of thinking, it's in organization, but also in a society, I think you could say, is that there's an incremental thinking. So it's kind of linear and you just go about it. And see, what happened with Tesla is that they were trying to imagine where will the automobile constructors be in 10 years from now when they were looking back then. And so that was this incremental curve. And they said, okay, we'll try to catch them up within 10 years, but it's going to be exponential because at the beginning, we're not good. And so we're going to make errors, we're going to do a number of things. And at some stage, as we keep on improving, because it's exponential, if you double, you know how it is, 2 and then 4 and then 8, 16, 32. Mm-hmm. What little people realize is that if you double 20 times, it's times a million. If you double 30 times, it's times a billion. Mm-hmm. So it's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once it takes off, it's taking off. Yeah.
There's a famous story in India where chess was invented, that the inventor did it for one of the Maharaja or kings there. And as the king was very happy, he said, how can I reward you? And he said, easy. Put one rice grain on the first of the 64 boxes and then double for the second and so on. And by half of the board, it was the rice production of the whole kingdom. Mm-hmm. So we don't realize that. What I'm saying, trying to say is that if you do that, you will accept to look stupid at the beginning. And Musk actually famously said, he said, new ideas are silly until there are no more. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. And that's why it's called innovator's dilemma. That means for a long time, you will have to accept to look stupid. to be the idiot in the room as you are building something. And then eventually the momentum is there. And something interesting happened to me last year. I started to think about, I mean, I'm a Luxembourger who came back after 20 years in the midst of the lockdown. And I really felt that I experienced the country as an expat. So literally, I left understanding in theory what it is, a frontalier, as we used to call it back then, someone just coming across the border. And then I was 20 years later back here in a place I had not known because I really had disconnected. And now I could not only think what it was, but I felt it. And I felt what it was to be kind of pushed aside when you come as a newcomer.
So you were a stranger in your own country, basically.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I said, how can I have this advantage in a way that I have been on both sides. How can I help? How can I help perhaps on the Luxembourg side realize that expats may see things differently? And how can I help expats better understand the rules of the game here? And an image I'm using is that if you're asking a Luxembourger to describe, to paint you Luxembourg, you get a picture. You ask an expat to do it, you get a different picture. Mm-hmm. Now, the irony is that the expat is aware that the Luxembourger sees something else, but not all the Luxembourgers are aware that expats see something different, because there's obviously it's logic. You're in it all the time. It's your natural. You grew up there. So it's hard to even fathom that someone sees it differently.
This is very true. And I was in a meeting. I'm not going to be specific, but there's some sort of business meeting with important people. And there were some people that were Luxembourgers and other people that were working in Luxembourg from Germany, France, wherever you name it. And we were talking about the Luxembourgers were like, no, there's no problem in Luxembourg. If you want to, you know, you can easily achieve this and you can easily accomplish that. But the expats, they were saying, no, it's really hard for us. You know, we can't really do this. So there seems to be a disconnect between what the expats perceive to be possible for them in Luxembourg and the Luxembourgers. So,
and it's really a perception. It's not something that is done willfully. It's not like they don't care. It's really something of cultural perception. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying, how can you help people see the other sides, perceive or start to feel it rather than thinking about it? Mm-hmm. And so I started this movement and we called it Hub Unity because it's kind of a hub and it's to bring people in unity. And look, all of a sudden, there's a movement of first people who go like, we want to volunteer, we want to help you. And then people come and have an interest for this thing. So I think there's people who are waiting for something, and it's just about, like I said, if you're purpose-driven, if you know how to do some storytelling to convey that purpose, why you do the things, and what is the unachievable goal that you have, those people who feel aligned with this follow you. And all of a sudden, it's growing. And so I actually am surprised by the thing, because I never thought it would go where it's going, and now it's like going faster than me.
I wanted to pick up on the neuroscience part about the storytelling. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about that because I think it's very interesting.
There's so many different aspects. We think the decisions we make are reliable. And so what I discovered is that it's not at all the case. First, with our senses that we have, we're capable of perceiving only 1% of the reality. Mm-hmm. That means a dog sees 100 times better than us, and so this is the five senses. So first, we only are capable of taking in data that represents 1% of a given reality. Then we have the different biases. So we're going to apply certain filters to that data. That means that our perception is not reliable at all. It's first, we only get 1%, and two, it goes through a number of filters, so it's already very subjective. And then the other element that is really interesting is that when we build a perspective, that means the opinion we have on something, again, we're going to apply a number of filters. And it's really interesting. Our brain is basically a time machine and a prediction engine. Mm-hmm. It's a time machine because it's going to take in all the data ever since day one. But not only the things we consciously take in, but also all the other things, the unconscious things. If you were to kind of visualize that, the conscious perception we have is like 2 square meters around us. The subconscious perception is a football terrain. So it's huge. So there's a number of things happening left and right down everywhere in our body that we never perceive. Like I mentioned before, Why do people perceive when something's fake? Well, there's a number of elements that the body will take in and we will just realize the things. So we have all this data coming in, and the brain then is a time machine because it doesn't make the difference between the reality and what we imagine. Mm-hmm. And one very, very obvious example, because people go, that's not true, an erotic dream. You think something and your body reacts. Mm-hmm. Well, it happens also for other things, that a perception we have, a meaning we have about somebody, about a situation, whatever, is going to influence how we see the certain things. And that's the prediction engine part, is that using all that data, the brain is capable to try to anticipate the next move. Interestingly, it's similar to how AI works, because AI is a probabilistic game of brute force, of analyzing a lot of data and then being capable to predict what will be the next word.
Yeah, they're very similar. They're just doing it at a much more volume and much more efficiency. Yeah. But yes, I think there's similarity.
Yeah. And that is the fascinating aspect also of the human brain, is that it does a lot of things and the consumption is extremely low. Mm-hmm. I mean, a human brain has a consumption of 15 to 20 watts. So it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And how does the brain do that? So evolutionary, to be capable to handle so many decisions. So I make kind of about 33 to 35,000 decisions a day. And we have between 60,000 and 80,000 thoughts a day.
That's a lot.
90% of which are repetitive. Every day we think the same thing. And if you think the same thing every day, it's like hardwiring in your system certain beliefs. And 75% more or less are negative. Why do we think negative? Evolutionary explanation.
Negativity bias, yeah.
We had to survive when there was mammoth and saber tigers and everything. And if you heard a rattling in a bush, you would first jump back, because if it was the saber tiger, you want to run.
Yeah.
You could still go later on and see if it was a little animal that you could eat, or maybe some berries or something in the bush. So we are wired to over...
It was essential for surviving.
The negative. So like literally we tend to perceive five times more the negative than the positive aspects of things. And so the brain tries to handle all these things. And because it's impossible with the consumption that is, or the energy that's available, the brain is consuming up to 40% of the energy that our body produces. And it's only like 2% of our mass. So it has developed a methodology that is really interesting, and notably based on something called the autonomic nervous system, the ANS. And the autonomic nervous system automates a number of things. That's why we do not need to think when we open a door, when we drive a car, when we touch something burning, we pull back the hand. So the brain has a number of routines that are automatic. And because it has all this data and it's trying to figure what will be the next move, it's basically guessing a number of things and triggers certain automatic reactions, so much so that it also happens with our thinking. That's why we can have preconceptions, some of the biases and a lot of things. Even emotions, neuroscientists thought that the emotions is something that you create somewhere in your brain. And now they realize, no, it's the same game, that sometimes the brain tries to predict something and will validate afterwards, but the emotion was there already before actually you perceive it. Mm-hmm. Which is why you can also retrain certain things. So, for instance, if you have to speak in front of an audience on a stage, you get nervous and you have a number of symptoms, like you're sweating, your heart is pounding, maybe your belly is a bit hurting or like making strange noises. You can literally tell your brain that this is not because you are nervous, but because you're excited that you will get to share something.
And by reframing
the whole thing, you literally convince your body and you can take control.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't know this, but the feeling of excitement and anxiety are very close. So they're basically the same emotion. So it's really, like you said, it's a matter of interpreting the emotion, right? Like you say, you can reframe it in a way where it's actually exciting and not anxious inducing, right?
Exactly. And then it goes even further. And if you want to connect with AI to say, okay, what makes us profoundly human? And then obviously the word that comes is consciousness. But then the problem is we can't define consciousness. We don't know what it is. So some argue that, yeah, some evolved AI might have consciousness because they are self-aware. But then I stumbled on an incredible study. It's called, the concept is called OOR. And the idea was to say, okay, how is consciousness happening? And they started to measure inside of the brain cells that we have microtubules. and they react, but they react in a way applying quantum mechanics rules. Mm-hmm. So, and therefore, so, you know, entanglement and all these things, which we barely understand today, they start to say like, oh yeah, maybe that could be one of the elements of the explanation. So that could mean that it makes us uniquely human.
I mean, any time you involve quantum mechanics, it's going to be complicated because of the both the wave and the particle, and so that's always. But I think it's something that's probably going to pick up in the future, is the combination of AI and quantum mechanics, right?
Well, I think that the irony is that AI will help us understand these things.
Well, that even better, exactly. Yeah. Right. So how does, you know, the part you mentioned right there about neuroscience and how we interpret different feelings, thoughts, and emotions, how did that relate to storytelling? So what aspects can you connect to these things that we know to storytelling?
Yeah. So what was very interesting is that at some stage, I was diving deeper into the methodology of doing storytelling. There's one famous storytelling expert called Robert McKee, and he wrote books about it. His story is that he was a screenwriter, and then he became actually a professor, and he taught a lot of screenwriters. And the word is that him and his alumni, if you want, have something like 80 Oscars of the best screenplays. So he must do something right. And so he developed a methodology, and the methodology is based on something called the hero's journey, which Joseph Campbell had famously written about in a book where he was analyzing Hercules Odyssey. And they found a structure in the story. And back to storytelling, I was saying we are geared for stories. Well, it so happens that for thousands of years we've been telling stories, and there was the way to convey information. They even believe that's why Homo sapiens took over from the Neanderthaler, who actually had a bigger brain, but they had not the capacity to do storytelling because they didn't have the appropriate memory to do it. And so basically he structured it kind of, usually you see the 8 steps of what storytelling is, how a story is structured. And the interesting thing is whether you take the Odyssey or whether you take Top Gun or you take Star Wars, it's the same structure. Mm-hmm. So he basically quantified how that works. And then when you dive deeper, you realize that if you apply the methodology correctly, you end up triggering certain reactions in the brain. And you notably have 5 important neurotransmitters, which is dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, endorphin. And optionally, you can have also adrenaline. And if you manage to tell the story correctly by triggering certain elements, something happens in the brain that all these neurotransmitters are being released, and it opens kind of a window that can go from 4 to 8 seconds where your brain cannot do anything else and take in what is coming. And if you did well and you have this aha moment, you look at really good ads that you remember, often something happens, you have an aha moment, and you cannot refrain from taking. And that's the moment where the slogan comes or possibly some music. I mean, an example I use in my class is Nespresso. Every time you have something happens, and then when it has happened, Nespresso, what else? Bing, bing, mm-hmm. Music.
Basically, if I understand this correctly, you're saying that good storytelling can induce all of the oxytocin and all of the different neurotransmitters. They interact like cocktail, so to speak, and create a good feeling about it, or your engagement with it, and how much you soak in the message. So basically, there's a direct impact of good storytelling on these neurotransmitters, and they create these feelings.
Exactly.
That's so interesting. Okay.
And that's what I love about it, because so it takes it completely to another level. It's not just a theory of writing a good story, because that's the thing. You have also, that's why also writers' rooms, they have a methodology. They will follow 3 different, it's called the Disney method sometimes, because you have a phase where first you are creative. That means everything is allowed. Just go crazy, imagine anything. Do not contest, do not say it's not working. Just encourage people to go wild. And writers' rooms, at least ideally you have 3 people, but for the famous show The Simpsons, it's a dozen people. Mm. Some even argue that that's maybe how they manage to sometimes predict such incredible things in such a regular very regular.
But they also have very talented people that do it. I know Conan O'Brien.
But they apply this methodology.
Yes, they do.
And so the second step is that then you go into a phase where you will be realist. Now the idea is to say all these crazy ideas, how can we build them together, anchor them in some sort of reality? Reality doesn't mean it's true. Dune is credible, but didn't happen. But it's built in such a way that it makes sense. And the last phase is you go critic. Now you're trying to torpedo the thing to make sure it's watertight, it's going to function. And when a story disappoints you, it's often that last point. Something was not structured right, and you can just feel it, and you're disappointed. Mm-hmm. But when the structure was well done, you will be satisfied.
It's like the ending of Game of Thrones. I don't know if any of you watch Game of Thrones, but great show, absolutely great plot, great characters. But I think everybody agrees that the last season was a huge disappointment. So yeah. I think that was quite a failure of storytelling in the way you just described it, right?
There was another one, like The Man of the High Castle, was the same thing. Same thing happened. Then you take other stories like those TV shows you have, like Wednesday. That's perfect. Mm-hmm. The way it's structured, the way it ends at the end, and then you have different plots coming together. Christopher Nolan is really an artist for that. He's really good at it. I mean, whether you take an Inception or Batman. Dunkirk. I mean, Dunkirk is crazy because it's three timelines that end up at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you have three reveals, basically, and then all of a sudden they go together. So you get a triple dip in a certain way.
Oh, and I even like his Batman movies are also great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But I think the people that do the stories, they probably don't even know about all of the science stuff, right? They'll probably just go by, okay, this works. But it's just so interesting to see that how our brain is wired in a way over centuries, evolutionary years, you know, centuries and decades, and hundreds of years, how we use storytelling to convey messaging, right?
Yeah. So the real professional storytellers, the screenwriters, apply this mythology.
Yeah.
And that's what I discovered in New York. I saw them doing that. Mm-hmm. I can give you another example that... Even I was like, nah. It was like they were saying, if you're sitting and brainstorming and imagining thing, it will not be as good as if you stand up and you move. And it is true, because if you stand up and you move, you literally liberate your brain, because our brain has been, again, geared to do two things at the same time, unlike what we think. We're geared to think and move, because as cavemen, we had to think and run after the bees to catch it. And so today, when you say to kids, for instance, do not move, stay still when you work, it's actually not good, because you need to put energy into not moving. Mm-hmm. Versus if you move, you liberate more energy for your thinking. And the other thing that you do is in storytelling and in writers' rooms is that you play the idea, you play the part of the idea. You imagine a character, whatever the idea is that is, even a notion, a concept, like, I don't know, jealousy, or you play that. And I made the test. I had people like who didn't believe me, and then they were trying to come up with something. And then I said, okay, now let's play the idea. You are this and I am that. And we played it, and you stand up and you move, and the creativity just enhances. Mm-hmm. So the professional ones really apply these methods, and there's a lot of things that they apply, even in P&L and stuff like that. And it's amazing.
And so you cover all of these aspects in your book as well.
Going through it. I mean, otherwise the book will be way too long.
Right.
But yeah, I really try to combine all the things we discuss. I've tried to bring them into a framework. And a fun read, I hope. Mm-hmm. So that you, I mean, I had a lot of joy learning all these things and discovering them. And then I tried to connect them. My approach is, I call that I grasp. That means I will gather information. And then I will assemble them like you would do with wine or whiskey. And then I simplify it so that I can propagate it. Mm-hmm. So I do the opposite of what a PhD does. A PhD will dive deep into knowing more and more about something. And I'm literally trying to bring a lot of elements and see how can I combine them in a new way.
So it's more of an exploratory approach.
I'm literally a jack of all trades, an expert at none. But here I'm actually really good at trying to combine the things in some unexpected. The same way I just had this idea we should register yachts on the Luxembourg flag with no C. Here's the same thing. So how can we connect certain elements so that they start to make sense and bring across a point?
Before we wrap up, because I think I've used a lot of your time, but there's one really important thing I think I want to talk about, and you've mentioned before also in other interviews, which is the importance of failure. You mentioned the fuck-up night. So first of all, could you explain what the fuck-up nights are, because the title is very enticing, so I'd love to hear more about it.
Sure. So it started because the Chamber of Commerce, the House of Entrepreneurship, had organized an event where they wanted entrepreneurs to come and talk about their failures, because they wanted to show it can happen, it's okay, and there's a way to overcome it. There's not many people who volunteered, and I was like, yeah, sure. So I did it, and in the room was the organizer of the fuck-up nights, and he came to see me afterwards and said, look, this is a concept which actually comes from abroad. It's a licensed thing. It exists in many countries where again, it's about talking about what went wrong so that people feel not alone, realize that it's part of the journey and that's there's not only a way of overcoming it, but it can actually be beneficial. So I said, yes, of course. And I had actually the audience laugh as I started to speak on stage because I said, they asked me to come here to talk about a fuck up. And I answered, which one? And they were like, God, so already, because already one is something. And then you want to talk about several. And that just means that it's part of our journey. I mean, look, kids fall to learn walking. It's just very natural. And the more you make errors, the more you learn. So the better you can become. The thing is, of course, that you want it not to hurt too much. I remember a friend of mine used to say, in life, the only thing that's free is school, and all the other lessons you have a price. So try to make the price not too expensive. So obviously, yes, you want to be smart about it. But there's a famous saying back to also the dichotomy of cultures, US versus Europe, is that over there, notably in Silicon Valley, there's one famous saying is like, fail fast, learn fast. And I remember I had an experience in Luxembourg working with people, and at some stage it didn't go as planned. And I'm like, fine, fail fast, learn fast. And then, no, we cannot allow to fail. It's not possible.
That's incredible. And I noticed this, and I'm like, it's almost like failing at something means that you are a failure, which is an asinine thought process, especially in the business world, because obviously you have to fail. I mean, even Elon Musk failed like a million times, and he even said so, like, because you mentioned him before. He said in an interview, I mean, I almost didn't make it with Tesla. You know, I was like a month away from being bankrupt and not being able to do anything. So of course you have to fail, right? Even to suggest that you cannot fail is something that is so, for some reason, and maybe you can speak to this here in Europe or especially in Luxembourg, seems to be something that's failing at something seems to be synonymous with you being a failure.
Yes, and I mean, not going into specifics either, but I know of a famous entrepreneur in Luxembourg who had a failure. And it would be so beneficial if he was talking about it and sharing about it, because he could help so many other entrepreneurs. As a startup community, we could become better thanks to that. But on the contrary, everything was done to hush it and like slowly close up the whole thing, pay whatever needed to be paid so that no one would really notice. And it would be better to say, look, this is what we did wrong, or this is what we've learned from it. Mm-hmm. But then there's very much the what will neighbors say, what we said at the beginning.
Yes, yes.
And it's being magnified, unfortunately. I mean, I'm thinking about myself. It took time to overcome not feeling stupid when it went wrong.
Yeah, and I still feel that way sometimes today, that when I fail at something, I feel bad about myself, because I have this feeling, oh no, I failed. And then it's, I didn't accomplish anything, instead of thinking, well, you failed, but what did you learn from it? And how can you use what you learned when you failed to do it better next time, or do something different next time, right?
I don't know if you saw the TV show Ted Lasso.
Yeah, so, I love it. I've watched it multiple times. With Jason
and so Sudeikis. I love it when he goes, like, when something went wrong, he goes, now you play the goldfish.
Short memory, forget
Move
about
on,
it.
Short memory.
Yes, yes.
Just remember the asset, which is what you've learned from it, and then move on. It's done. You can't undo it, but you can learn from what went wrong.
Yeah, and I also think it's not lingering on the negative feelings, right? If something didn't go right, I think we tend to overthink about it and be like, feel bad about it, and it's going to affect our work going forward. It's going to affect our thinking, to kind of detach yourself from this.
Yeah, well, I can connect that with neuroscience again. That's what we were saying before. We will five times more weigh on negative things compared to positive things. So it takes rewiring. It's an exercise. The same way you exercise your muscles, you can rewire your brain by learning to think in a different way, but it takes time. I mean, this machine has been working in a way for decades. It's in us. So it obviously is a little bit of an effort to rewire, but that's basically what's the difference in a culture, US, Europe. It's maybe just because they got wired from kids already to think just slightly different, but it doesn't mean we have not access to it. We can do it, but it's an effort. It takes time and it's a daily effort.
So would you concur with the statement that it doesn't matter how often you fail as long as you learn something from it?
I even think that
You would go further.
The more you failed, the more you've learned.
So you would say, well, I would say it's probably, but I would put a caveat on it. I would say, yes, you can fail a lot, but you should also learn from it. I think that's important.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just failing all over and over again. And I think there's this statement by, I don't know if Einstein said it, that insanity is if something goes wrong and you do the same thing over and over again, yes, expecting a different outcome, right?
Yes.
So I think the important part is the critical evaluation of why something failed. I think that has to be said, I think, as well, that it's not just the failing part, but it's assessing why did I fail and what can I learn from this.
There's a wise saying in Luxembourgish even about it that says, a smart donkey will only hit once.
True. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So, yes, make mistakes, but not the same mistakes. Every time you evolve, I mean, it's a thing of progressing, right?
Right.
And then in one given field, you will do less and less, which will open up then the possibility to try other things. And then you do other. So it's not like you keep on doing failures, but it's like you move on, you do things. You mentioned Elon Musk. He had failures with the cars and then it became better. And then he has failures with the rockets and then it becomes better. And then it evolves. It's actually even a process. And that's also interesting how we are geared towards negativity. And it's being amplified also by media, is that although it was known that the approach was to say, we're going to try this new big rocket, the Starship, and we know it's going to explode. We are trying, and then every time it's going to become better. The first ones, every time it exploded, you could see the media all over the media saying, another failure, but in a bad way, right? When it was programmed. But so even it was known, it was said, but the media wouldn't take over that part just to focus on, oh God, he messed up.
It's almost like a visceral reaction that we have that when something goes wrong, our brain immediately reverts to, oh, this is a failure, this is terrible. And and so, like you said, I think seeing things in context, I think, is most relevant here.
Yeah, and I think that's really perhaps one of the possible conclusions, that if you appreciate how the brain functions and that there's also a possibility to rewire your brain, and there's different methodologies to do that, not only will you learn, but you will become a better version of yourself. And you can do more things. I can tie that with the question you asked before. That's perhaps one of the things that keeps me going, that helps me stay optimistic and positive.
I think that's a great closing statement. First of all, thank you so much for taking your time. Very fun and interesting conversation. Hopefully, I see you around on one of the fuck-up nights. I think that's something that I would really love to see you talk about it and express your failures to an audience. I think there's a whole lot we can learn from this. The main takeaway message being, don't be afraid to fail, take risks, be innovative. I think those are the type of people that we need.
Yeah. Well, I plan on sharing about it further. Hubunity will be one channel, teaching at the
school. Good luck with your book as well.
And then the book, so The Culture of Purpose.
Yes.
So stay tuned, but sometime in spring.
Okay, great. I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Pascal.
Thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure.